you sit down, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Please, everyone, take a seat as quickly as you can. Again, I want to thank you for being here at our closing sessions. I will do the proper thank yous in a moment. But Prime Minister Brown had a few moments. He has got to go down to Washington. He's trying to lend us a hand in our hour of financial need. And I want to thank him in advance for supporting the proposition that America should take some vigorous bipartisan action now to stem this. I'm very grateful to him for sticking his neck out for our country, and I thank him. He's been a great friend. So I'm going to give him the floor, let him make some remarks. I want to say two quick things. Number one, I met Gordon Brown almost 20 years ago when we were much younger, had a few more illusions, but no less idealism. I have watched him in his leadership capacities as Chancellor of the Exchequer and as Prime Minister. He is a brilliant, gifted, well-motivated man, and most important, he understands the world we are living in. Number two, there are two manifestations of that. First, he has tried to mobilize business leaders all over the world to do the kind of work that we're doing here with the support of the UN. He's gotten a lot more business people to promise to do more in their businesses and has asked us, along with the Secretary General, through the Clinton Foundation to help implement those commitments. So we're honored to do it, and we're going to try to figure out some way to give them some credit here next year. But it's a big deal. Number two, if we haven't learned anything in the last 6 months, we should have learned that it really matters whether you understand how the economy works and whether it can be made to work for ordinary people, and he does. There are very few people in positions of leadership anywhere in the world today with anything remotely approaching his capacity to understand these complexities, turn them into policies that are likely to get us through a crisis and into a better day that benefit everybody. For those reasons alone, I am very grateful to him. Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you. Can I say, first of all, I wanted to come here amidst all the financial worries to pay tribute to the power of an exceptional man who has transformed the world and made a difference to hundreds of millions of lives, Bill Clinton. In Europe, they say these days that politicians are like what Shelley said about his mother-in-law, that we've lost the art of communication, but not, alas, the gift of speech. But Bill Clinton, after being the successful president he was, has created an initiative where 200 million people have already benefited from what he has done. £30 billion raised, working in 150 countries, a magnificent achievement. And 200 million people are not just statistics. I was in Tanzania a year or two ago, and I met a young girl called Miriam, and she was orphaned. She told me her mother had died, and then her father had died. She herself was part of a group of 40 orphans, and you know Africa has 12 million orphans from AIDS. And she was explaining her story to me. She was disheveled, she had no shoes, she looked as if she'd utterly lost hope. In her eyes, I saw someone with an unreachable sadness, and she was suffering not just from tuberculosis, but she had been infected with HIV. And she was suffering not just from disease, but from a broken heart. And I kept in touch with this girl and kept trying to find out what we could do to help her. But you know, the Clinton Global Initiative and other charities working with her have made sure that that girl is not only alive, but prospering. That's the power of the Clinton Initiative to change lives. You change lives, one hope at a time. And that is one of the great stories that I can tell you about the success of the Clinton Initiative. I went to another part of Africa, and I met a man called Paolo. And Paolo was suffering from HIV, AIDS. His sister was a young schoolgirl, and she told me because her brother was suffering from AIDS, she wanted to be a doctor, but you knew immediately that was beyond her because there was no chance of her even finishing our school because of lack of money in the home. And this guy, Paolo, he couldn't even afford the travel to get to hospital for help. And he told me, I'm despised here, but are we not all brothers? Now, Paolo is another person who has been helped as a result of the successful deal that President Clinton done and has achieved over these last few years. Another life saved. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, and now millions of people around the world who perhaps Bill will never meet, but who owe to him their chance to live and to prosper as a result of the work he's done. There was an Oxford University professor who asked his students to do an essay on the achievements of Gladstone. You know our English universities, modern history ends about the end of the 19th century. And he got the essays back, and he marked the essays. And he said of one essay, he said, very, very interesting, but it might have been helpful if you'd at least talked about something that Gladstone had done as Prime Minister. But for Bill Clinton, he has changed the world once as President, and he's changing the world again. I'm so proud to be a friend of President Clinton. I want to talk in the minutes that I have about what I see happening in the global economy and how I see out of this, although we have huge difficulties, the opportunity not just to build successful institutions that will make the global economy work better, but to build a truly global society where we recognise the interests that we share in common, indeed that we are global citizens together. If you look at what's been happening over the last few years, we've had some of the benefits of globalisation, cheap consumer goods coming out of China particularly, that allow people to have higher standards of living, particularly electronic goods and clothes. We've had low interest rates for 10 years as a result of the counter-inflationary pressure that comes from manufacturing goods being cheaper than ever before. But now we're seeing that despite these great advantages that have given us higher standards of living, and advantages that I believe make globalisation still a huge opportunity for every one of us. In the next 20 years, the world economy will definitely double in size at least. And that means there's double the opportunities for those people with initiative, with enterprise, with ideas, with products, value-added products that they can sell, services they can sell. And the countries that are going to benefit from that are America with its great list of innovations and achievements in enterprise. And I hope that Britain will benefit too. But what we're now seeing are the problems that we have to address. And these are global problems that now require global solutions. We see, first of all, the restructuring of jobs all over the world, and it makes people insecure. So manufacturing jobs are changing all the time. I personally believe you can say to a worker, we can't help you save this job because it's going to be redundant at some point, but we can help you get the next job. And that is the role of parties like ours to be able to do that. So you've got the first problem, and that is massive restructuring that makes people insecure. When I was in Washington at the IMF a few months ago, there was demonstrations, and one of the slogans on the demonstrations was worldwide campaign against globalization. And you can see the fears. It got worse in France with protectionism when they ran a campaign in 2007 that said no to 2008. But you can see the worries and the fears and the reflected in what people are saying about the jobs. But then the second problem that we've got to deal with is not just the risk of protectionism and how we deal with the restructuring of jobs. The second problem is the pressure for resources. And all around the world, I think you draw one conclusion from the high food prices, but particularly the high oil prices, that long-term demand for oil and for food and for basic commodities is exceeding the supply of it. And until we solve that problem, then we are going to have volatile oil prices and potentially volatile food prices. So we're seeing the first pressures of globalization in this area. Rising populations demand rising standards of living, particularly in Asia, and the pressures lead to a scramble for resources and what people are now calling a resource nationalism. And we have to have answers to that problem. And interestingly enough, it's exactly the same problem that we've got to solve because of climate change. We have three basic energy issues ahead of us. One is energy security because of what's happening in Russia and elsewhere, affordability, which is raised by the rise in gasoline prices here, and you have the issue, of course, of climate change. And they all point in one direction, but the interesting thing is you cannot solve this by national measures alone. You can only solve this by global action. If you've got a source of inflation in your society that is based on a commodity that is actually sold globally, like oil and food, then you've got to deal with that at root. And it requires us to act together as governments to do this. And so there is no future for isolationism, as there is no future for protectionism. We have to agree, and it will mean changing the terms of the debate about energy. And I believe changing the terms of the debate about energy means a vast shift in the way we use energy. And that means that we in Britain will be moving ahead with nuclear and renewables. And at the same time, we're trying, like you are here, to find a new way of getting the car working for us by moving to hybrids and electric cars. But we've got to change the debate about energy, and we need the Arab countries and the oil producers to recognise that they too have an interest in a stable energy policy rather than a volatile oil price. And we have got them to agree, and we're calling a conference in London in December the 19th, to get them to agree that they should invest the oil revenues in other sources of energy so that we can create a stable energy market to their interests and to everybody else's interests. And then food around the world. Isn't it amazing that Africa has 70% of its population on the land, it has 20% of the world's land, and it is a net importer of food and produces only 6% of the food of the world. So a continent that is basically got huge amounts of land, unable to produce food even for its own people. And only 5% of land in Africa is irrigated. And if we are to solve the food shortage problem, which means that food prices are going higher in all countries, then we have to have a global solution, and that global solution has got to involve Africa. And we've got to look at how we can move forward on that. So pressure and resources. And then the third problem of globalization we've now got to deal with is how we build a global financial system. I mean, I've got no doubt, as President Clinton said, that this proposal to bring liquidity into the American system that has been put forward, whatever the details of it, is in principle not only the right thing to do, but is an essential thing to do to begin to restore confidence in markets. And I've got no doubt other countries, and I've talked to people all over the world who have been at the United Nations this week, from Latin America to Asia to Europe and to Africa, they all want that liquidity injected into the system to give us the stability we need. But we know there are bigger problems than that. And basically, the problem is, and it goes back to the point, global problems need global solutions, that we now have global financial markets, we now have global capital flows, but we have national supervision, and we have no effective global supervision. And I've been proposing for some years now that the International Monetary Fund or a similar organisation has got to be an early warning system for the world economy, that we've got to have consistent rules across frontiers, that we've got to have means of proper transparency, that we've got to have responsibility where it is lacking in boardrooms, where they must understand the risks that they're taking because their ordinary customers are affected by that, and we've got to get rid of the conflicts of interest that are at the heart of some of the system. But the basic point is there. You're in a global economy with global financial markets. In any other area, if you had a global issue to deal with, you'd have global cooperation that would make it easier to solve a problem. And I believe as we move forward from solving the liquidity problem and the problems of solvency in some institutions, we must now build a global financial system that means proper supervision that everybody can support, so that outside America you don't have, effective havens in other countries where people can hide assets and at the same time make it impossible for a global financial system to flourish. And then there's the fourth problem we've got to deal with in globalization, and that is the problem that everybody has been talking about also this week. It's the gap between rich and poor. as Bill has said on so many occasions, rightly so, we have a world that is unsustainable, we have a world that is unsafe, and we have, for many people, a world that is unfair. And it's more than unfairness. I was in Nigeria a few months ago, and I went to a school there. I actually went there with Bono, the singer, and he's a very good friend and does a huge amount of work on behalf of charity, and I'm very proud of what he does. And we went to this school, and it was just outside Abuja. There were all these pupils there, and they were three to a desk. Many classrooms didn't have desks, completely dilapidated. Teachers had no equipment, and the children were complaining. They wanted a decent education but couldn't get one. But they were children like every other children in every other country. When you asked them what they wanted to be engineers, they wanted to be doctors, they wanted to be nurses, they wanted to be lawyers, they wanted to do all these sorts of jobs. Ambition and aspiration was not missing in any way. None of them wanted to be a politician. Actually, Bono was quite surprised because none of them wanted to be a pop singer either. And then I was told the story about what was really happening in this area. A few miles up the road, a madrasas had been opened, offering education free of charge, great facilities, a lot of investment coming out of other countries put into this school, teaching extremist ideology, making sure that in return for getting free education and great facilities, the children were effectively being brainwashed. And therefore, we have a problem that is not just an economic problem about opportunity and a social problem about justice and a moral problem about the rights of and dignity of every child. We have also a security problem. And I believe if we don't face these challenges about the gap between rich and poor around the world, if we don't have a new deal that binds the richest countries to the poorest countries, but that is possible and I can see how it could be done. The richest countries demanding of the poorest countries that they are open and transparent and free of corruption and they run economic systems that allow them to make for prosperity for their people and open up to trade in return. We help them finance their education and health and their economic development so that they can join and benefit from the global economy. But this is a problem that if not solved, and if not solved soon, I believe the tensions will grow between the richest countries and the poorest countries, and people will ask themselves, why can I not have some benefit from the globalization that is happening around the world? And I went to also, I wanted to just say about some of the other things I did when I went to Africa. I saw so many children that were lacking in opportunity, but I also saw so many mothers. And my wife Sarah has been involved in a campaign, the White Ribbon Alliance. And you know, there's one story that really has never left me. It's about mothers in Africa and India, because the chances of surviving pregnancy, because of the inadequate facilities, because there is not the treatment there if the pregnancy is going wrong, who during their pregnancy go round and say to their friends and relatives, goodbye. They think that they will not survive. And in Sierra Leone, 1 in 8 mothers dies in childbirth. It is an astonishing and appalling statistic. There are only 80 midwives in a country of 6 million people. There are only 200 nurses, only 100 doctors. And if we can't help with the basic equipment and the basic help in midwifery training and other things, then I believe that we will be failing a generation of people who deserve our help. And that's why the Millennium Development Goals are so important. And that's why, in my view, we should build upon them. There's a story about Richard Nixon going to Africa to celebrate the independence of Ghana. And the year was 1958. And Richard Nixon was rather gauche in the way he was dealing with people when he was in Africa. And he thought the best thing to do was to go around the crowd. And he started talking to people in the crowd, and he said, how does it feel to be free? And he said to the next, how does it feel to be free? And again, how does it feel? And then one chap said, how should I know? I come from Alabama. But there is a point, however, in this story, that after 50 years, America has solved its problems of civil rights, but in Africa, we have not solved the problems of social and economic rights for the individuals there, and that must be part of our mission. But I just want to say one final thing. The opportunity that exists for us is not just to build the institutions of a global economy, a reformed International Monetary Fund or an organization that is an early warning system for the world economy. I believe that the World Bank should be a bank for the environment to give the funds for investment that would allow countries that are too poor to adopt climate change policies to do so. I believe that the United Nations has got to transform itself because it's got to deal with the breakdown of states and the terrorism that is implicit in that, and it's got to have an agency for the reconstruction of countries that involves not just military help but civil help, and I believe that these changes could be made immediately and help build the institutions of the global economy and global society. But I think we also need to do one other thing. We need to recognize that we could in this generation not only eradicate illiteracy amongst children, not only eradicate the diseases like tuberculosis and polio and malaria that still threaten the lives of far too many people and cause millions of people to die unnecessarily when we have the technology and the science to do it, but I believe we could also build a truly global civic society. And what people find across the internet or in communication with people from other countries is, contrary to what they believed, they have more in common with each other than they thought. They find that the golden rule of every single religion, and 5 billion people are involved in the religions of the world, has the same central golden rule: treat others as you would be treated yourself. And whether you're a Sikh or a Muslim or a Hindu or Judaism or Christianity or any of these Buddhism, all these religions have this central golden rule: treat others as you would be treated. The idea of fairness to each other and responsibility to each other. And I believe that given that we have more in common than people have thought, and given that we are opening up communications across frontiers, what we are failing to do is to build the institutions of a global civic society as well. The internet, some people call it a shouting match without an umpire, when people are chatting to each other and blogging. But remember the power of it in the last few years. When Burma was undergoing the violence that we saw reported, the first information that came out of it came from monks blogging and giving information to the rest of the world. And problems that would have been hidden years ago cannot be hidden. You can try and suppress people, but you can never silence people because of the means of communication we've got. When the Zimbabwean elections were on, the reason Mugabe could not fix the first election in Zimbabwe was because people were using their mobile phones to take photographs of results that were announced at local polling stations, and therefore he couldn't take the results to the centre and change them. In the Philippines, some of you may know, there was a president that fell in the Philippines when people texted to each other and said that they wanted to get rid of him because of his corruption, and it was called, in fact, at the time, they all assembled together, a million people, it was called the first coup de text. And we're seeing the extraordinary power of people to communicate with each other. We're seeing that people have amazingly in common so much in the philosophy that they hold. We're finding that when people meet, they can find so much common ground, and we're finding that NGOs and civic groups are building up all over the world, and we have got to have the means by which we recognize that in greater effect by building the institutions of a global civic society. Now, whether that is young people, you had the Peace Corps in America, and Bill created a great organization for young people. Perhaps this should be a global organization that allows young people to work in other countries and involves every country in the organization of that. Perhaps we can create global organizations where people can communicate and discuss about major issues in a more effective way. I am absolutely certain that if disasters befall or violence or genocide, the world would know about that very quickly, but the world has got to be in a position to act. And of course, it means that business too must be involved. Businesses are global. And what we've seen in the Clinton Initiative is the power of private individuals to change things and to change the world. Bill changed the world once as president, and he's changing the world again by his actions as a private citizen. But this global economy and this global society creates more opportunities than ever before for people to actually contribute to the public good. And I'm not asking business leaders to contribute just charity and philanthropy. I'm asking them to use the enterprise, the skills, everything that they've learned in business to apply to some of the great problems of the world, including building economies in some of the poorest countries of the world. I had the great privilege with President Clinton to be at Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday party. And this was an extraordinary occasion where people flew in from all over the world to pay tribute to a man who had actually changed the world for good by ending apartheid. And then the next night, there was a concert for Nelson Mandela, and all the top singers around the world came to see it. And I was privileged to sit next to Nelson Mandela as he was looking at the performers in the concert. And I had the duty of explaining to him who Amy Winehouse, the singer, actually was. And I knew he was quite interested, and I had to explain a number of things that that you all know about. And then Amy Winehouse was telling other people, she said, you know, President Mandela and my husband have a great deal in common. She said, both of them have spent a large part of their lives in prison. And then when everybody was singing Free Nelson Mandela at the end, you could actually see that she was singing Free Blakey, my fella. But this story has an important point to it. Nelson Mandela, there at 90, having climbed this huge mountain and seen the end of apartheid by what he had achieved. The evil of apartheid ended as a result of his action and the support that he had been able to get. What was he telling us at 90? He was telling us at 90 that was an even greater mountain still to climb. And what he was saying there was that what we had to do was to fight a bigger fight, and the fight was against unfairness and injustice around the world. And if Nelson Mandela at 90 is calling upon us to take action, to build a global society that is true to the values we represent and understands that we cannot continue as nations separated from nations without at the same time proud of our national identity, linking up as nations to build a truly global society, then I believe we have got a duty to listen. It's said in ancient Rome that Cicero, a great orator, used to speak to the crowds, and everybody came to listen to him. And after he had spoken, they went away saying, great speech. But it said when Demosthenes in ancient Greece came to speak to the crowds, people came to listen to him, and then they said after they heard him speak, let's march. And I think the causes of the world require us to act together. This could be the generation, and we could be the people that gave every single child in the world the chance of schooling. But 77 million children are not at school. This is the generation that could end the needless deaths from diseases that we know we have the power to cure. This is the generation, the fortunate generation, that can make off the opportunities of this new global economy a more inclusive and more sustainable globalization by sorting out the problems of poverty and the environment. I believe that we are summoned, all of us, to build a world where globalization becomes not a force for injustice, but a force for justice on a global scale. I believe that is the duty of this generation. I know that everybody here can contribute to that and is already. Let us change the world together. Thank you.
Thank you, Prime Minister. We wish you well. We wish you well later today. Go down there and help us. I want now to announce our last round of commitments, after which we will have a video which will briefly tell you what you all committed to do here. And then I just have a very few words, and we're almost done. But it's really been a great 3 days. I hope you've all found it worthwhile, and I'm very grateful. We have begun to do at this meeting something I think we'll do more of now at every meeting in the future, which is to give you an update on the commitments that have been previously made to demonstrate, number one, that we really are keeping up with the commitments that were made, and number two, that they really are making a difference. 2 years ago at our 2006 meeting, the Global Network for Neglected and Tropical Disease Control committed to tackle and eliminate treatable, disfiguring, and life-threatening parasitic bacterial infections. Last year, they added to their commitment, announcing the launch of a public awareness campaign so that people could access the services available. Now, to provide us with an update on what has actually happened is Dr. Peter Hotez, the president of the Sabin Vaccines Institute and the chair of microbiology at George Washington University Medical Center. Dr. Hotez, please tell us what's happened.
Thank you, Mr. President. Since you helped us launch the Global Network 2 years ago, the answer is a lot has happened. For those of you who don't know what neglected tropical diseases are, these are chronic parasitic and bacterial infections such as hookworm, and schistosomiasis, river blindness, elephantiasis, trachoma. These actually represent the most common infections of the world's poorest people. They actually produce a disease burden that exceeds malaria. They have a disease burden that exceeds tuberculosis almost as much as HIV/AIDS, but few people have ever heard of them. In fact, it's very hard for me to speak to such a large group. When I talk about these worm infections, they're neglected for a reason. Usually I get four or five people in a room, and it's a testament to you to be able to fill the room to hear about these parasitic worms.
If you spent a life in politics, you know a lot about such things.
It turns out that almost all of the bottom billion, the people who live on no money, the people who live on less than a dollar a day, are affected by one or more of these neglected tropical diseases. And these worms are the stealth reasons why poor people are trapped in poverty. They prevent child growth and development. When a child has chronic hookworm in his belly, he loses 43% of his future wage earning, a calculation recently done by a University of Chicago economist. A huge impact on pregnancy, school performance, school attendance, 25% decrease in schools performance and attendance. This is why kids don't go to school. Agricultural productivity. India loses $1.5 billion a year in agricultural productivity because people are too sick with elephantiasis because of the disfigurement in their genitals, in their limbs. Since our Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases, which is an alliance of these major NTD partnerships, and we have a couple represented here today, the International Trachoma Initiative based in New York and Helen Keller International and others, including Deworm the World that you acknowledged yesterday, and, of course, the Sabin Institute, was founded in 2006. We estimate that 147 million people have received rapid impact packages of these essential drugs that target the seven most common neglected tropical diseases, costing as little as 50 cents a person per year. Amen. So imagine solving a problem as great as malaria or TB, almost as great as AIDS, for 50 cents a person per year, enabling them to live healthier and more productive life. This is neglected tropical disease control. NTD control is now recognized as one of the most cost-effective measures in all of global health. Since the launch of our Stop NTDs campaign that you helped with, we've seen exciting momentum build. UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon recently elevated the profile of neglected tropical diseases at a meeting of the elders held in Atlanta, and the leaders of the G8 for the first time placed NTDs on their summit. President Bush has called on the U.S. Congress to invest $350 million to fight NTDs. Here at CGI, actress Alyssa Milano committed to NTDs, and as a result, more than 3 million people in Haiti will receive treatments for NTDs. former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, has announced that he will serve as an ambassador for neglected tropical diseases. We didn't get there alone. In addition to your very important help and the help of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the low costs and efficiencies of the rapid impact packages for neglected tropical diseases are made possible by generous donations by GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. Merck has had a 20-year commitment for donating Mectizan for river blindness, as well as a critical program development by the World Health Organization and the African Program for Onchocerciasis Control, which has trained over 500,000 community drug distributors. This is the answer, we think, to the Africa resource problem, an army of 500,000 people who can distribute these drugs, and it turns out when they bring bed nets with them, the use of antimalarial bed nets goes up ninefold by using these community drug distributors. So today we're embarking on a call to action to eliminate the neglected tropical diseases in Africa, Asia, and the Americas as one of the most dramatic and cost-effective and low-cost ways for achieving the Millennium Development Goals. And I'm just so grateful that you gave us the opportunity to appear here today. Can't thank you enough.
Thank you. Give him a hand. That's great. Let me also remind you that there are an unknown but large number of people following this meeting with our webcast. And we have provided for an opportunity for people of modest means to make specific commitments through mycommitment.org. If you're looking for something discreet you can do at 50 cents a pop, any commitment that comes through mycommitment.org to this effort is one that you know has perfectly predictable results, which the good doctor has so eloquently outlined. We thank you very much. Now, I have four more commitments to announce, and then we'll watch the film, and then I'll let you go. I just have one or two things to say before you leave. I'd like to invite to the stage Margaret McKenna, the president of the Walmart Foundation, Patricia Compass, a student at Caltech State University, Dick Muyambi, a student at Bucknell University, Leka Tumapali, a student at Harvard, Youngjun Hao, a student at Swarthmore, and Justin Zorn, a student at George Washington University. Hello. Thank you.
Hi, sir.
Hey, Margaret.
How are you?
Thanks. This is quite an important commitment. And I wanted to do this to emphasize something that is done anonymously by our commitments office often. We have a lot of people come to CGI from the NGO community from all over the world who are full of good ideas, who need something done and need it financed. A lot of the best things that happen at this meeting are people bumping into each other in the halls and talking about their common interests. I'm quite sure that a lot of good things have happened that we don't know about and haven't recorded. But we convened our first meeting of the CGI University last March in New Orleans. We had over 600 students from the United States and 15 other countries. They all made commitments to actions. Not all of them could be funded by the students on their own. So CGIU and the Walmart Foundation have committed to funding innovative, high-impact work that creates lasting and positive change, supporting the four main focus areas of CGIU: energy and climate change, global health, human rights and peace, and poverty alleviation. Following the inaugural CGIU meeting at Tulane, 44 students in two universities received grants to further their work around the world. This year's recipients included efforts to provide drinkable water to victims of natural disasters within a day, something that we could have done with twice in the United States in the last 2 years. The making of bicycles available to low-income families in Uganda and offering no-interest loans to clients in danger of eviction from homes. So the Walmart Foundation is helping these young people to implement their good ideas. And I have no doubt that as they get out of school and make good because they got this help, someday they'll do the same for others. Let's give them all a big hand. This is great. I'd like to invite Victor Pinchuk, the founder and chairman of the Victor Pinchuk Foundation, to come up. Also one of the major sponsors of CGI and CGI Asia, along with his wife, Elena Franchuk, who's here. This is a very important commitment. You know, in all the countries that were part of the old Soviet Union or the Warsaw Pact, there has been a fascinating emergence of entrepreneurs and real politics and real debate. And in every country in different ways, there have also been some uneven results because you're coming out of one political culture into a dramatically different one. And we were talking today about, I've been heavily and emotionally involved, I confess, in the democracy movement in Ukraine. I tried to support both this president and his predecessor and the country. It's very important. It's a very large country, strategically located in terms of geography and the political psychology of Europe's future. And we were talking about our frustrations at the various political impasses that have occurred. But we know one thing. When it comes to putting aside yesterday's resentments and creating tomorrow's realities, the young people are almost always on the side of the future. Almost always and almost everywhere. So what Victor is committed to do is to launch a worldwide studies program to train a new generation of Ukrainian leaders and professionals by providing 500 master's fellowships to talented young citizens of his country to study in other nations at the world's top universities so that they can help to modernize their country to meet the challenges of the 21st century. This may be the first time such a large international education philanthropic program has been enacted in the Ukraine. He is prepared to spend $30 million to get these 500 kids prepared to lead their country and his country to a better tomorrow. It's a great deal. I would like to ask Her Excellency Reem Al-Hashimi, the Minister of State for the United Arab Emirates, to come up. Thank you. Through an organization entitled Noor Dubai, the commitment is to combat blindness in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East by fighting river blindness in Africa, building pediatric centers to prevent avoidable childhood blindness, mitigating vitamin A deficiencies affecting millions of children around the world. 4 out of 5 people who lose their sight need not have done so. Shall I say that again? 80% of the people who can't see in the world should have their sight. Research shows the estimated cost of global blindness and low vision will cost the world $110 billion in lost productivity by 2020. For this $10 million commitment, a great difference will be made, and we thank you very much. This is the last commitment I'm going to announce, and It's sort of a mega one, so I'm going to call a lot of people to the stage, but I want to set the stage here. This is a big deal to me. After the recent devastating hurricane struck Haiti, I began, because I'm all on Paul Farmer's list, I began to get his running emails of just how bad it is. A lot of you know that Dr. Farmer and his partners in Health Group, we work with them in Haiti on the AIDS issue, and they have agreed to take over a lot of the health initiatives that we are doing, and we work through them in Rwanda and Malawi through the Clinton-Hunter Development Initiative. So Paul starts sending me all this stuff, and then I see pictures of Wycliffe Jean in Haiti doing good work with Matt Damon and others, and then other people start writing me. So then I called the president, and he said, after I talked to Paul Farmer, he said, the United States hadn't given enough money. So I called President Bush, and I said, you're a bigger deficit spender than me. Won't you send him some more money? We had a funny... It's a great thing, you know, when you can't run for anything anymore, you can be friends with everybody. He laughed, but the United States sent them more money. And I applaud him for that. They spent a good deal more money. It was a noble thing to do. So we got everybody kind of looking at this. Then it occurred to me that the losses were so great in Haiti, but the talent and yearning for a better future is also great. And I think Haiti is poised to make more progress in less time than it has been in the two decades that I have been concerned about this country. And I should tell you that the person who's saddest not to be here today is Hillary. Chelsea and I talked to her. The Congress is still struggling with the financial issues, so she couldn't come. But in October of 1975, we got married 33 years ago. And 2 months later, we took a delayed honeymoon, thanks to a friend of ours, to Haiti. I've been in love with the place ever since. And I've often wished that we could do more. So it occurred to me that in the aftermath of this storm, we should think of Haiti in the way I was honored, thanks to the United Nations and the Bush-Clinton Tsunami Fund, to think about the tsunami countries. That our goal should be to build them back better than they were before the storm hit. And that this was an opportunity, if we all got together, to do that. And I asked a young man who's worked with us in our AIDS program and our energy program, our Joe Cashin, to try to coordinate this. And I want to thank Joe, but I want you to listen. These people I'm going to bring up and explain to you what they're doing, hey, they have done this in 1 month. So there's going to be a huge crowd on this stage. We may not all be able to be on the same level. We're going to try. I would like to ask first the president of Haiti, René Préval, to come up here and stand with me as we recognize these people. Come, come. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to ask now, invite the following participants to stage. Greg Allgood from Procter & Gamble and Lisa Hamilton from the UPS Foundation. Richard Rowe from Open Learning Exchange. Ad Melkert from UNDP. Ray Offenheiser from Oxfam. Wycliffe Jean and anyone he wants to bring up here from his foundation, Yale. Matt Damon and Frank McKenna from One by One. My college classmate, Dominican American Argentinian Rolando Gonzalez Bunster, who is involved in energy in the Dominican Republic and is helping. And Ambassador Steve Green and the Green Family Foundation. Rashinda Van Leuven from Good Energies. Blake Mykowski from Tom's Shoes. A great outfit. Ann Hastings from Fancozzi. Ted Widmer from Brown University. and Dr. Paul Farmer, who has been in Haiti now for more than 25 years. There are some people who, for reasons of space or absence, cannot be on this stage, but I want to acknowledge them, including Ruth Messenger from American Jewish World Service, Bill Lowry, the Haitian Education and Leadership Program, American Institute of Research, Concern Worldwide, and many more, including Dennis O'Brien, who was here and had to leave, who is the largest cell phone provider in Haiti, perhaps one of the largest employers, an Irish supporter of the work we do in AIDS and other things around the world, who told me once that Haiti had convinced him more than any place he'd ever been that talent was equally distributed because the young Haitians who hawked his cell phone cards on the street were the best entrepreneurs he'd ever encountered anywhere in the world. And he works, by the way, in Haiti, Papua New Guinea, many other developing countries, liberating people through their access to cell phones. I'd also like to thank Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, who called this morning and said they would rebuild 12 schools in Haiti, as they have been doing in New Orleans. Now, all this materialized in 1 month. It shows you what we can do if we work together. And it really is an argument for the point made by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf at the beginning of this, that we should harmonize these meetings more. And if you notice, I know it might have been somewhat strange to many of you when we started doing a lot of these multi-partner AIDS commitment announcements. We had all these people up on the stage. But as you can see, they're self-reinforcing in wonderful ways. So let me just tell you, among the things that have been committed, to give families, 20,000 families, food every month, to supply 36,000 farmers with seeds, fertilizer, and training, to provide 5 million liters of clean water, to rebuild thousands of homes, to improve education for more than 600,000 students, to rebuild 2 destroyed bridges, to provide 100,000 pairs of shoes. I want to plug, if I might, Blake and Tom's shoes. You know, every time you buy a pair of those shoes, he gives a pair of shoes to a poor kid in a developing country. So every single one, one for one. And so this is the beginning. I want to say again, if you want to be a part of this in any way, shape, or form, if this is all we do, it's nice. I will consider the whole idea a failure. The purpose of this is to effect, purely through the NGO movement, what we attempted to do and in many places succeeded in doing in Aceh and Indonesia, in southeastern India, in Thailand, in parts of Sri Lanka we would have made more use if it hadn't been for the political upheaval, and in the Maldives. We want it to be better when we are finished than it was before the storm hit. We need a lot more help, a lot more work, and across a whole wide range of areas. But this is a very good beginning for just 30 days of hard work. So let's give all these people a big hand. Okay, now in an effort to get you out of here quicker this year, and we have truncated a report on what happened in each track, but I think it's really important since we all met here to look at what we're doing that you know what you did. I want to therefore, I just sort of set this up by saying, I know you could have been many places this week, and depending on where you're from and what you do, your mind could have been on a lot of other things. But we've had current, former, and future heads of state and government here. From my country, we've heard from Republicans and Democrats and people in between who understand it won't be just a single party worrying about the heat of climate change or responsible for dealing with the formidable challenges that our country faces. We have talked a lot about how a successful society and a globalizing economy requires good market economics, good government, and effective civil society, and we've talked about what all of us could do to fill the blanks. At the beginning of this meeting, we had nearly 1,000 commitments that impact 200 million lives. You've heard that over and over again. What you should know is at this meeting, we have already, and many people always make a commitment after they leave and have time to think about what they've absorbed, already 250 new commitments worth $8 billion that will impact 158 million people, almost as much as we've done in the three previous years. And so that includes 16 million children in the deworming programs, 25 million with improved school feeding, 44 million metric tons of CO2 that won't be emitted, clean energy enough to power 7 million homes in America, 75 million people with better health care, $375 million more dollars to develop new vaccines and pursue other medical research, 1 billion liters of safe drinking water, 50 million people with mobile financial services, $400 million more for investment and credit for small and medium-sized entrepreneurs. There has been a really deeply committed staff here. I want to thank them all. The CGI staff, thank you, Bob Harrison, Ed Hughes, Mary Morrison, Michelle Kahane, Joe Volliver, Lydia Gilbert, all the working group chairs, thank you, Tom Khalil, Jane Wales, David Sandelow, Gene Sperling, your deputies. Thank you, the commitment staff and everybody who worked on this. I want to thank my staff at the foundation, including Doug Band, whose idea this was. I wish I could tell you this was my idea. This was his idea, and it's worked out great. Our chairman, Bruce Lindsay, my chief of staff, Laura Graham. Thank you, Matt McKenna, Hannah Rickert, Ami Desai, thanks for all your work. Thank you, Tasha Alvarez. I'd like to thank the people who work on the Clinton Foundation programs who have participated here. Our AIDS program, our climate change program, our magaziner, Anil Soni, thank you very much. Thank you to all the people who work on all of our other stuff who keep it going, even though I don't ask people for money for you here every year. We have, and I'm very grateful for that. I'd like to thank our sponsors, our founder, the sponsor, Tom Golisano. Thank you, Victor Pinchuk and Elena Franchuk. Thank you, Vinod Sakar, for making this possible and for making it possible for us to go to Asia in December. I want to thank all these folks at the Sheraton. They work so hard for us from top to bottom. Thank you. They're great. Thank you. I want to thank our media partners. Everybody was part of the awards ceremony last night, but especially Sue Endure, who actually came over here and had to fly. When he left here, he had to fly all the way to Paris to perform. He came here one off because he believes in what you're doing. And I'm very grateful to him. I want to thank James Taylor and our remarkable array of presenters, America Ferrara, Julia Orman, John Chambers, and Robert Kennedy Jr. And for all of you who have enjoyed all these pictures and reports about what's going on around the world, the person you have to thank most of all, I want to recognize Courtney Spence and Students of the World. They have captured our CGI projects around the world and presented them. Let's give them a big hand. They have really done a great job. So, I would like to Now, I think it would be appropriate to show the videotape, if it's ready, of what else has happened here. Well, are we ready? Yes, no, maybe? No, that's Amory Lovins. He's just trying to hawk another clean energy project. What? We're ready. Go.